We're back to the Lara Coates Show, only on Sirius XM Urban View.
Welcome back to the Lara Coates Show here on Sirius XM Urban View, channel 126. I am joined now by a fabulous and compelling author, Sarah Snyder, who is a professor at American University and author of From Selma to Moscow, How Human Rights Activists Transformed U.S. Foreign Policy, out later this month on April 24th. Sarah is a historian who teaches at American University School of International Service, also the author of the award-winning Human Rights Activism and the End of the Cold War, a transnational history of the Helsinki Network. She advanced a new interpretation of United States foreign policy in the long 1960s, showing how the transnational connections and social movements spurred American activism on human rights. Welcome to the show, Sarah. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so glad that you're here. I have to admit, I Googled you at first, and I was like, oh, did she Jaden Smith? That's not you, though.
It's not.
you're far more esteemed. Which way you can follow her or go to her website at sarahbsnyder.net to distinguish yourself from that young woman. Oh, you're fabulous and young anyway. But you've written this really great book that talks about a period in American history and also talks about this really kind of odd connection. Why Selma to Moscow?
So the book, the title was an inspiration, I would say, as a maybe 3 days before I submitted the manuscript. I was pulling all-nighters, trying to, you know, sort of polish the manuscript as much as possible. And I was looking at a photograph of a sign that was at a 1965 rally in Philadelphia on behalf of Soviet Jews. And the sign said, Selma or Moscow, human liberty is indivisible. End Soviet anti-Semitism. Mm. And so activists at the time were making these connections and essentially saying, if we're going to support equal rights for U.S. citizens, we need to also support equal rights for people who don't have the benefits of U.S. citizenship in foreign countries. And so there were a lot of links between people who were active in the civil rights movement and then people who went on to become active in the battle for protecting human rights internationally.
It almost seems like the idea of human rights emerged when you realized that we were part of this kind of Pangea of sorts. You couldn't advocate here at home and then have wars that were fought other places to secure a variety of freedoms. And that kind of played very well in the civil rights era as well. But is this concept of the human rights or the idea of human equality and humanity, was that new coming out of that period of time that it emerged from that? Or was there an earlier point in history when everyone kind of said, we have to have more of a global approach to human equality?
Well, certainly in the late 1940s, when the United Nations was founded and people like Eleanor Roosevelt were involved in negotiating the UN's Universal Declaration of Human Rights, that was a moment in which there was incredible attention to enumerating rights and to talking about their universality and the extent to which they were indivisible. Essentially, you couldn't only have some rights that were protected. And then for a range of reasons, mostly because the Cold War was heating up, human rights became kind of a bad word within the U.S. domestic political context. And I would say there were a few reasons that went into that. One was a concern within the South that this human rights language could be used to champion the rights of African Americans. But there were also Americans who were concerned that if the United States signed on to international human rights treaties, they might somehow be threatening national sovereignty. And so we really see a decline throughout the 1950s and into the early 1960s of people using the language of human rights and of human rights being seen as something that the United States should be championing and leading on. But one of the things that I argue in the book is that as the United States made strides domestically on civil rights, as legislation such as the Civil Rights Act or the Voting Rights Act were passed, as African Americans gained greater visibility in public life, international criticism of the United States' race record declined. And so then Americans felt as though they were able to speak more forcefully about rights violations overseas. I would say some people explicitly wanted to learn from and capitalize upon the successes of the civil rights movement, but others, I think, felt less encumbered by domestic problems in speaking out about, say, human rights violations in the Soviet Union or in Greece or in elsewhere.
You know, it's fascinating to think that as the certain people in the United States of America, including Black Americans, gained in prominence or were allowed to have a more, fruitful part in American society, that was a correlation to how we were criticized abroad. And it seems as though perhaps when people were talking about the issues of America or our global positioning, it almost seemed to serve our interest suddenly to believe in human rights as opposed to one that was a sincerely held belief about equality for everyone. Did you find in your research that the notions of human equality or human rights was more of a financial advantage for America, or was it one where we were really kind of the beacon of morality?
So I would say that you certainly have people who champion human rights for sort of Cold War reasons. They want to criticize the Soviet Union. They want to criticize other communist or Eastern European countries. You do have some people who downplay human rights violations because they want to gain financial aid, as you were saying. And we can see this particularly when we look at interests within the United States who wanted to continue to import chrome from southern Rhodesia, even though there was a white minority regime there that the United States ostensibly should not be supporting. And there are a few other cases where I think we can see business interests leading the U.S. government to downplay attention to human rights. But much more than that, it's most often about anti-communism, about the Cold War, and about being willing to overlook repressive acts by particularly a military dictatorship because they're seen as an ally in the fight against communism.
So when you're talking about human rights almost as being an entree into a discussion on foreign policy, and it opened doors for other things and emboldened American diplomats, or I guess around the globe as well, to be able to say, hold on, now that we've taken away the issue of how we should be criticized when you hold a mirror to us about equality issues, how did that then influence foreign policy in, say, the non-socio-political ways or social justice ways? Did it have any impact at that point in time?
So I would say that a few things happened. One, certainly diplomats started to say, well, you know, we should feel more emboldened to be critical. But they also said, we are acknowledging the imperfections within our own system, and we are trying to address them, and you should do that too. So they weren't trying to say, essentially, we're perfect on human rights, but they were saying, look at the steps we're taking, whether it's through court decisions or legislation to improve our record on human rights. We acknowledge our flaws, and you should do that too. So I think they were trying to meet some governments a little bit halfway, as opposed to just saying, we have solved everything and we are the sort of moral beacon of human rights.
Did that discussion of how they were not trying to be preachy, but almost like, look at what we're doing, we too are joining this discussion in this movement, did that go over well for people, or was that seen as a yeah, right sort of moment?
Well, I think it probably depends on the audience. I mean, one of the most prominent examples of this was in 1968, which was the International Year for Human Rights, sponsored by the United Nations. There was a conference in, of all places, Tehran. And Roy Wilkins, who was the executive director of the NAACP at the time, led the U.S. delegation there. And he gave a speech that acknowledged sort of all of the flaws in terms of fulfillment of rights within the United States, slavery, segregation, but talked about the ways in which the United States was improving. And his speech went over remarkably well with the delegates there. It came just in the wake, actually, the anniversary is very coming up very shortly, because it came just in the wake of Martin Luther King's assassination. And so I would say that his message was really warmly received, particularly by newly independent African and Asian countries that were attending this conference in Tehran. But certainly in other instances, and I think particularly among Soviet or Eastern European audiences, there was a sense that the United States was only talking about rights in certain contexts, only maybe talking about political and civil rights and not acknowledging issues in terms of social and economic rights, whether we're talking about unemployment or homelessness or access to health care or education, et cetera.
And certainly people who are pro-communist regimes, whoever those people may be, who are pro that, often believe that this notion of democracy or about the kind of pseudo-equality that America, they believe, was professing during the civil rights era before, you know, they took their own, you know, mea culpas in this issue, they almost see communism as being a great response to in trying to improve and trying to create equality, and that is the actual endeavor. And so do you have a sense that over the course of American history and human rights campaigns that the idea between communism and democracy is constantly at battle over the issues of human rights and equality?
Well, certainly throughout the Cold War, there was a sense that the United States and its allies were championing different types of rights than the Soviet Union and its allies were. There's a fascinating new book by a colleague of mine, Stephen Jensen, that argues that actually that sort of picture really simplifies the extent to which other countries, he really focuses on Jamaica, but other newly independent countries are focusing on rights relating to religion, race, that other rights are also being championed internationally at this time. But so I guess what I would say is that, and your question was about sort of the criticism that the Soviets and other governments are making about the United States. You know, there is a right in the Universal Declaration about the ability to participate in one's own government. And I think that the United States and its allies would say that they were focused on the rights that enabled people to make their own choices. And if you can't participate in your own government, then you can't have any say about the type of economic or political system that you have. So they did, I think, sometimes prioritize certain rights over others. And certainly we can see them prioritizing things like bodily integrity, right? The right to be free from torture, the right to be free from politically motivated imprisonment. And so they did define the term human rights much more narrowly than human rights activists today might.
I'm talking to Sarah Snyder, professor at American University and author of this fascinating book, From Selma to Moscow, How Human Rights Activists Transformed U.S. Foreign Policy, due out on April 24th. Also go to sarahhbsnyder.net, and she's the author also of Human Rights Activism and the End of the Cold War, a transnational history of the Helsinki Network. You know, your work takes on a really long journey. It talks not just about the 1960s. We go into the 1970s as well, and how the human rights activism campaign continued to really put in motion a lot of what we have today in foreign policy. Tell us about that period of time.
Yeah, so the book covers what I term the long 1960s. So it really begins with John F. Kennedy's inauguration in 1961 and talks about early efforts to pay attention to human rights in that administration, and then focuses on human rights issues that Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, and Gerald Ford confront. So it goes into the mid-1970s and really takes us up to Jimmy Carter's inauguration in 1977, which a number of people have sort of pointed to as the beginning of U.S. attention to human rights. But my research showed that that wasn't the case at all, that almost everything we think about as being the essential components of U.S. attention to human rights were in place before Carter even entered the White House. And these include things like legislation that the United States can't give economic or security assistance to governments that engage in repression of their citizens' rights. That legislation was passed on the economic side with the Harkin Amendment in 1975, and in terms of security assistance in 1976. The sort of institutionalization of human rights within the body of the State Department is also something that's the result of legislation and hearings that come before Carter comes into office. And this is, say, the creation of a Bureau of Human Rights and Humanitarian Affairs, an assistant secretary to head that bureau, and also the creation of country reports on human rights were an outgrowth of this legislation about security assistance, because there was this sort of language in there. There's always some type of exception for national security.
Right.
And the language at the time said that the security assistance could only be given under specified circumstances. And so the State Department was charged with, initially, they wrote 17 reports on countries that were receiving security assistance. And now they write reports on every country that's a member of the UN. And these country reports, going back to what you were sort of talking about earlier, are incredibly important to signaling to foreign governments that the United States is regularly monitoring their human rights records. I think that the country reports give comfort to human rights activists who are suffering abuse overseas to know that someone is watching what's happening to them, is championing their cause. And they signal to the world the extent to which the United States cares about human rights as an element of its foreign policy. And that's why I wrote something recently saying that I really hoped that Rex Tillerson would personally present the country reports when they were released this year. Of course, this was before he was fired. And so
it won't be him.
Well, it won't be him. Who knows when the reports will come out. But I do think that the extent to which the administration and the Secretary of State sort of publicly presents these reports signals the administration's intentions in terms of human rights.
Talking to Sarah Snyder, author of From Selma to Moscow, How Human Rights Activists Transform U.S. Foreign Policy. And take a quick break here in the Laura Coates Show. When we come back, we're going to talk about one of the criticisms people have about human rights campaigns around the globe as relates to America, because it seems sometimes that the global human rights campaigns can outpace what's happening domestically here in the United States of America. We'll be right back.
You're listening to The Lara Coates Show on Sirius XM Urban View.
Welcome back to The Lara Coates Show here on Sirius XM Urban View, channel 126. I'm joined by my fabulous guest, Sarah Snyder, professor at American University, and also author of this really compelling read called From Selma to Moscow, How Human Rights Activists Transformed U.S. Foreign Policy, due out later this month on April 24th. Also follow her and go to her website at sarahbsnyder.net. Sarah, before the break, we were talking about the idea of, some people point out that Americans seem to do a great deal for people outside of the U.S. They have a lot of causes they want to support. They certainly want to talk about human rights. And we seem to lag behind in some ways the endeavors we do in other nations. Your book focuses a lot on the American activists themselves who find themselves advocating on behalf of human rights campaigns worldwide. Tell us about the focus that you had on these activists. Who were some of the people you focused on, and what was their motivation for being a part of these movements?
What I found is that most of the Americans who were active in the years that I'm looking at, sort of the 1960s into the early 1970s, were motivated by transnational connections. And what I mean by that is that they went abroad as a missionary or as a Peace Corps volunteer or as a student, and they met someone overseas. In one case, they fell in love and married this person. In other cases, they grew very close to them through organizing or through religious services. And when those people's human rights were violated, they were motivated to act upon their behalf. So I think that one of the reasons that we see Americans becoming much more interested in international violations of human rights in these years is that the 1960s really marks an explosion of Americans traveling and working abroad. And when they return, they draw upon these international experiences to become much more engaged in human rights issues.
And, you know, it's odd because normally you're talking about what motivates somebody to become an activist on the home front. They may have experienced a personal bout of discrimination. They may be the victim of prejudice in a variety of ways. They may have grown up in a family who has a connection someplace else. But your book focuses on, especially with human rights activism, we don't have that exact causal connection, that link that you normally do.
Exactly. I mean, in some ways, it's not surprising that, say, someone whose family descended from Poles might be interested in human rights violations in Poland. And so what I really wanted to look at was Americans who didn't necessarily have a connection based on identity. And how did they become involved in campaigning for human rights issues overseas? So just to give you one example, in 1967, there was a coup in Greece, and one of the most famous political prisoners there was a man by the name of Andreas Papandreou. He had recently returned to Greece from the United States. He had been working for many years in the United States as an economist, and he'd worked in a number of universities across the United States, including at Berkeley, at the University of Minnesota, and at a school in New England. And so he had a broad network of economists all across the United States who immediately, after he was arrested and imprisoned in the wake of the coup, wrote to the White House. Over 250 economists wrote to the White House and said, "Save Andreas Papandreou." And this was an issue that actually rose all the way up to Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon Johnson said, you know, "I'm going to tell these Greeks to lay off this son of a bitch, whoever he is." You know, Johnson didn't know who he was, right? But he knew that prominent Americans cared deeply about this person's life. Frank Newman, who was on the law faculty at Berkeley, knew Papandreou from his time in California, and he went to Greece to try and seek his release from prison. And this drew Newman into a wide range of human rights activism. He got involved in the wake of the coup in Chile in 73, but it was all because he knew Andreas cared about him and wanted to save him from being executed. So there's a wide range of these sort of transnational connections that I argue are what motivate Americans' activism in the long 1960s.
And so when there's not that extreme immediate connection, did you feel that when you researched, did you feel that it undermined the ability for people to advocate these positions, not having that personal connection? Did LBJ have any less, in one example, any less interest because it was almost a attenuated sort of or tangential relationship? Did that almost become like a hardship in the promotion of these activism, or had no effect at all?
No, I think it's very significant. I mean, if you in the book, I look at five cases: the Soviet Union, Greece, Southern Rhodesia, South Korea, and Chile. We know that there are a lot of other countries in these years that had significant human rights problems,
right.
Thinking particularly of China or Iran. But there's almost no U.S. attention to what's going on there. And I think one of the reasons is that Americans are not traveling and working abroad in these countries as much as in some of the other places that I mentioned. And so there isn't necessarily a kind of natural constituency to be advocating for human rights within the U.S. political context.
And you write in the book about Congress taking an interest, not just people like LBJ, but also Congress taking an interest. And actually, a lot of the activism of the people you're studying in these five different areas in particular had an impact on legislation that continues to be important today.
Absolutely. So members of Congress are really key because at various points throughout the years that I'm looking at, the White House is quite resistant to these human rights activists. And I would say that's particularly true when Henry Kissinger is Secretary of State. He really doesn't see human rights as a topic that should be a priority in U.S. foreign relations.
Yeah, I mean, it's really a throwaway, the idea of human rights, sure. Among humans. I mean, yeah, this human rights thing, sure.
Mm-hmm. But Congress, and this is in part because Congress was resurgent in many areas of foreign affairs in these years in the wake of Watergate and sort of other scandals. It increasingly takes on a role in shaping U.S. foreign policy, and because of its role in the appropriations process, it's able to do things like say, we're going to cut off all assistance to Chile because we disagree with their record on human rights. So it's really members of Congress who are able to sort of achieve as much as possible what the human rights activists are advocating for. They're able to cut off economic and security assistance. They're able to send public signals, say, by holding marathon hearings on human rights violations in particular countries. And that's actually one way that advocates are able to bring the issues they care about to the fore is by testifying before Congress and submitting documentation to support the claims that they're making. So this is really, I would say, a moment where Congress is very significant in U.S. foreign policymaking and to great effect in terms of trying to limit the extent to which the United States supports repressive regimes abroad.
Now, I know your book, From Selma to Moscow, How Human Rights Activists Transform U.S. Foreign Policy. Sarah Snyder, I know that it focuses a great deal on the long 1960s, as you're calling them, 1961 to 1976. But I can't let an expert like you, who's so renowned in your field, go without talking about how this is resonating today. The idea of America and foreign policy has taken the center stage once again in even our global marketplace, from places like China, North Korea, what's happening across the globe, Honduras, you know, discussions about foreign aid, et cetera. And the conversation goes on with the EU, et cetera. Do you see the role of foreign policy and the U.S.'s role in it as critical or less critical now than it ever was?
Well, I would say that I don't think that the role of the United States in foreign policy could be less critical. I mean, I think the role of the United States in the world remains essential. But what was really striking to me in May when Rex Tillerson spoke to State Department employees, he said essentially that promoting values inhibited U.S. national security interests. And that
promoting
was,
values
yes.
inhibited national security interests. How?
Well, I think what he was trying to say was that the United States, and I think he was trying to sort of fit into a narrative that you were alluding to earlier, that the United States doesn't want to preach to mm-hmm. other countries and impose, quote, its values on other countries, get away from maybe some of the rhetoric and policies of the George W. Bush years. But what was striking to me about that comment was, one, I think that's a total misreading of the place that human rights can have in U.S. foreign policy. I think, and this is something that John McCain and Marco Rubio and many prominent Republicans on foreign policy, so I don't think it's a sort of a partisan issue, have said, is that promoting human rights enhances American security in a number of ways. But the other thing that was really striking to me was that he was suggesting that somehow human rights were only an American value. But we know from talking about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights just a few minutes ago that this is something that since the late 1940s, all countries have committed themselves to. So I don't think that when we talk about the role of human rights in international relations, we should see this as some sort of project or plot by the United States. Actually, the United States has very often been following or lagging on the promotion of human rights, but this is an international commitment to protect the rights of all people, regardless of their citizenship. And so it seemed that the Trump administration was really going to break with about the last 40 years of U.S. foreign policy with this statement. And I've been hopeful that that might not be possible for a few reasons. One, the institutionalization of human rights in U.S. foreign policy that I talk about in the book. A lot of this legislation is still in effect, and I think it will be difficult to overturn because there's a lot of support within Congress for issues of human rights. Also, Americans, I would say in the wake of this activism, have come to see human rights as a central part of U.S. foreign policy and to see this as reflecting something very positive about the role of the United States in the world. Just to give you one statistic, in 2015, 77% of Americans said that the United States should be a world leader on human rights. And I don't think that those numbers have eroded considerably. So I do think that despite what Tillerson said, hopefully the United States will continue to champion human rights internationally, even if it's maybe not coming out of the White House. But there are other branches and actors within the U.S. government who can make sure that this remains a prominent issue for years to come.
Can the United Nations, what role, I mean, I know Bolton, who is the new appointee for State Department Secretary of State, has talked about the United Nations could have 20 less floors and still be fine. And I know the U.N. is normally the vehicle in which people talk about human rights atrocities and talk about how to deal with them on a global scale. Will his appointment have some impact, do you think, on the way in which human rights are dealt with going forward? In many ways, we can't know the answer to that question.
No, we can't.
The mustache hasn't spoken. But
as a historian, I'm particularly cautious about making predictions. Mm-hmm. I would say that I think that with his appointment as National Security Advisor, he could have less of an impact on U.S. attention to human rights than if he'd been appointed to be Secretary of State,
right,
where he would oversee this process of a sort of annual monitoring of human rights through the country reports. There's been some writings about him that have talked about how, despite these quotes about, you know, sort of lopping off the top 10 floors of the United Nations building, that he was actually very engaged with diplomacy at the UN Security
right.
Council. And so I think we'll have to see what happens. But I would say that one of the things that I found in researching the book is that the reason that these human rights activists focus so much on Washington and members of Congress is that they'd really grown disillusioned with the UN as the body through which human rights could be best protected. And I think some of that skepticism may remain. You know, is the United Nations the most effective body for protecting human rights internationally, or are there other paths that will offer sort of greater success for curbing human rights abuses?
We'll have to all wait and see how that plays out, especially if we're talking about the quote you gave about promoting values was somehow going to undermine national security. Now we've got somebody in national security advisory position and how that's going to dovetail with the State Department as well. Sarah Snyder, professor at American University and author of From Selma to Moscow, How Human Rights Activists Transformed U.S. Foreign Policy, due out April 24th, wherever books are sold. Please go to her website at sarahbsnyder.net and also pick up her other book. It's the award-winning Human Rights Activism and the End of the Cold War, A Transnational History of the Helsinki Network. I just want to ask you before you go, Sarah, what is your interest in human rights and how did you get to be so fascinated by the topic?
So I'm someone who, whether it was at the undergraduate level, when I got my master's or when I got my PhD, I never took a class on human rights. It wasn't actually something that I was particularly interested in. What I was interested in was the years of detente, when the United States and the Soviet Union were trying to reduce tension and find ways to work together. And while I was looking for a dissertation topic, I went to a talk at the Woodrow Wilson Center here in Washington, because I got my PhD at Georgetown, and someone said, well, there's this agreement, the Helsinki Final Act, which was actually incredibly important for détente, and no one has written about it yet, which is really all what we're looking for,
yeah,
right? Something that's
right.
important and understudied. So I started doing research, and I was really confused because what I discovered was that during the Nixon years, Nixon and Kissinger had been totally skeptical about this agreement. But by the time Carter became president, the United States was enormously supportive. And I was trying to understand how U.S. policy could have reversed so dramatically. And what I learned was it was the result of human rights activists, primarily in the Soviet Union, but also in the United States. And so I got drawn into human rights really for the ways in which I saw activists could impact U.S. foreign policy and shift it.
Well, you know what, Sarah? That is an amazing tale, and I'm so glad that you have used that drive and that passion to educate us all, especially in this new book, From Selma to Moscow, How Human Rights Activists Transform U.S. Foreign Policy. It's a pleasure speaking to you. Hope you all pick it up, and we'll see if past is prologue. Up next is the Power Hour with Godfrey. Come back tomorrow. Follow me on Twitter and at the Laura Coates. Have a good one.
I'm the man, I'm the man, I'm the man. Yes, I am, yes, I am, yes, I am. I'm the man, I'm the man, I'm the man.